This is tape two, side one of the October 10th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder.
So we homeschooled, and there were some funny things that happened. Among other things, we were told to have our daughter Shanti, whom we'd given an Indian name to find some stones, so they could do something with a lesson of stone. Where we were living was in the Ganges, River area, which had been silted for centuries, and there were no stones. It was you dig down for 50 feet before you hit any stones, because the floods would come, and then silt would settle, and then more silt would settle, and more silt would settle. So we had to settle for bricks. There were no stones in the area. Or I guess we found some stones over by the railway, where stones had been brought into some kind of palace. And other forms of adaptation. But it worked pretty well. The only thing that I should probably throw in here was that I did become a quack doctor. I'd been advised by the three people on the faculty who sort of supervised my departure to the field. One of them was, they were all wonderful people. It was Talcott Parsons and Bob Bella and Cora Dubois, all absolutely distinguished scholars. And at one point, when they were talking about my project, Cora Dubois had said, what do you do, what do you plan to do as far as giving medical assistance to people? And I said, I'm not going to touch that. That's something I'm any good at. And she said, well, let me demand that you not do that. I've just gotten through a very touchy thing with one of my students who was out in the Southwest studying the Zuni, I guess it was. And a woman had had a headache and had asked to get something for the headache, and he'd given her some aspirin. And then 3 days later, she died. And the premise was that he had either poisoned her or done some witchcraft. So the tribe, he was given the choice of standing trial for witchcraft and murder, or just clearing out. And he'd gotten in touch with Cora and said, so what do I do? And she first of all said, you're an idiot. You should never, don't. And then it's up to you. If you want to, you know, you're dealing with a strange world with witchcraft, you may be found innocent, you may be found guilty. Well, he decided that since he would lose his dissertation entirely if he left, that he would stand trial, and he was exonerated. So he decided the aspirin didn't do it. But anyway, Cora's message was, don't you do the same thing that he did. So I didn't. For months and months, we moved into the village in November in the tents. We actually had a Brahmin priest perform a fire sacrifice so that it was all. The village insisted there be a proper investiture. And it wasn't until August that people would come up with cuts and bruises and stuff. I was not a doctor. And then in August, some kid had fallen off a wagon where a metal piece had been sticking out, and a chunk of flesh had been taken off just below the kneecap. So you actually could see a little bit of the bone, and it just kind of flap hanging. And they had put in paper and stuff to try to seal it up, and I could see that wasn't the right thing. There was a Salvation Army hospital in Moradabad, the city that was about an hour away by train. There's a German doctor, there's an English nurse with the Salvation Army, and they spoke English. So my standard reply to anybody was, go to the Salvation Army hospital, they're good people, they'll take care of you. And if anybody was willing to go, I'd write a note to the doctor saying, just let me know what it costs, because these are poor villagers. And nobody would go. They just would rather, the fear of going to the city and then being turned down, where do you stay overnight?
Right.
So anyway, this had happened, and they brought the kid to me, and I went through my drill and go to the city and all the rest. It was probably mid-afternoon that it happened. Then I went out to do something else and came back around 5 o'clock, and they were still sitting there with this kid and this big gaping cut in his left front of his leg. And I said, well, what are you waiting for? And they said, we're waiting for you to change your mind. And at that point, I felt the way the British must have felt with Gandhi. And this isn't fair. And I said, look, I'm not a doctor. There is a hospital. And they said, look, if you're a little boy that had this happen, you do something. And that's all we're asking you to do, just whatever you do for your kid. And they had me on that.
Yeah, right. Why? You're
so
stuck.
Yeah, I didn't realize what was going to happen. But that we had disinfectant, and I sort of cleaned it off. And it was a pretty neat slice. I sort of tucked the flesh back in and put a bandage around it. And then I went through my drill again, go to the hospital, this should be stitched, this must have been cut. And they were back the next afternoon saying, well, you know, I do want to see it, because if it's an infection, we can probably keep it from getting any worse. And from that point on, they had me. And they were back the next night, and I had to look at it, and there was a little bit of pus, and I had to clean that out. And then the next night, a kid who had a runny nose, and then the next night, the grandmother had an ache in her shoulder, and it was on and on. And I was thinking, Cora, I don't know how to stop this. I said I wouldn't die. So from that point on, I actually would set up clinic hours from breakfast to lunch and ordered lots of quantities of inexpensive medicine from the missionary place and dispensed a lot of stuff. Most of it was the stuff that you could work with.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, cuts and bruises. The typical problem with a cut would be they'd put grass or leaves or paper on it, feeling that the stuff shouldn't come out.
Uh-huh.
With the result that they would infect it very often. And so the important thing was to cleanse that off and put some kind of a clean bandage on. And once in a while, there would be a very dramatic cure. There was a woman who came who had been bitten by a monkey that had sort of dropped on her and got panicked and bitten her in the forearm, I guess. And she came in and her arm looked like one of those long, shiny balloons.
Oh.
Just, you know, the skin was as tight as could be. And here was the bite with paper and grass. And as soon as I was able to get down to it, the pus just began to ooze out.
Uh-huh.
And by massaging it, I got a whole pile of stuff out. And then put disinfectant, and within 2 days, her arm was sort of back to normal. That's one of my great successes. I had some that weren't quite so successful. There was one time I thought I might have killed somebody, and that wasn't good. I never gave medicine to a person I didn't meet.
Uh-huh.
And this was a case where a man came after dark, which was rare. People felt the grove of trees we were in was haunted by ghosts.
Uh-huh.
Because it was between the cremation ground and the village, and the notion was that ghosts would come and hover in the trees until they were placated, and then they would drift on out. So here was a man who was already scared. He said, my brother is just having horrible, horrible stomach pains, and he's not been able to have a bowel movement for days. Do you have anything to loosen things up?
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I had some stuff which was pretty good, but I also remember that as a Boy Scout, you weren't supposed to use laxatives in case the appendix had ruptured or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. So I went through this back and forth, and then I'll bring him in the morning. He's in terrible pain. So finally, just a little ago, I said, okay, here's some pills, and they may help, because they're pretty good as a laxative. So off he went. I was awakened the next morning by one of the villagers who said, the man to whom you sent the medicine died. And I thought, oh, bummer. This is Cora Dubois. And there was the funeral procession. And, you know, it was something not pleasant at all. And only in the afternoon did somebody come and say, you know, if your medicine had reached him, he might have lived, but he had died before the medicine ever got him. They had no idea how relieved I was. My laxative not had anything to do with this poor chap dying.
Oh, gosh.
And my favorite misdiagnosis was there was a lot of fungus, especially in the rainy season.
You know, oh, sure.
Hair, you know, fingers and feet and stuff like that. There was some zinc endosalinate which burned like fury. I'd had the same problem, and I put it on. But it was good. It just really healed the fungus. And so when I would put it on people, I'd say, this is going to hurt, but it'll be good, and we'll bandage up, usually the break in the skin or break in the hair or whatever, armpit. Well, this guy came, and it was his toes, I guess, and he had cracks in his toes. And so I went through my little speech, this is going to hurt a lot. Began to rub it on, and he showed no sign of pain. I was quite impressed. So I bandaged up and I said, come back 4 or 5 days and let's see how it's doing. This is pretty good stuff. Well, he showed up again 4 or 5 days and there was no change. The breaks were just as bad as everything. And I guess I tried one or two more applications. I said, no, this, I don't know what this is. It's not responding to what usually works. And I went through my drill about the German doctor and the Salvation Army hospital and the train. And he was one of the few people who did it. I really didn't assume he was going to, but I said, here's a note, give it to the doctor, because it's whatever it is, it's not working. We showed up about 10 days later with a note from Dr. Grumsch, the German doctor. Dear Joe, this man has leprosy. And that explained everything. That explained the cracks. That explained the fact that he didn't feel anything.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, fortunately, the doctor had said there is a way in which we can treat leprosy, and then you check in for these periodic inoculations. So I think in his case, he may have come out okay, but anyway. At that point, I just said, well, I misdiagnosed it. You know, everyone of us is allowed to make an error once in a while.
So you and the German doctor had cordial relations?
Well, pretty much so. I mean, what I was doing was crazy. I mean, I should not have been doing it, except that there was stuff that I did help some people, I'm sure. I did no good for a lot of people, I'm also sure. I don't think it hurt very many people.
Well, do no harm.
Do no harm, right. He was very, very bitter about Americans. He had been taken as a German prisoner of war, had been held in an Italian war camp. This all came out later. He had nearly died in a toilet full of feces. The care that was being given was horrendously bad.
Uh-huh.
And I guess as the war was ending, and there was just nobody doing much anything, and he apparently was very weak and fell into essentially a sewer pit and could hardly get out, and nobody seemed to care particularly. And I get whatever. I mean, it was clear that he had been hurt by the way the war had operated. But he was always similar, and several times he was a great help. My wife developed hives at some point, and he was very quick to diagnose what it was and give something.
Mm-hmm.
We did bring the English nurse out once to help me in my clinic. She lasted about 20 minutes, because you're standing there with people, you know, holding up their hands and their eyes full of pus and stuff like this. And she was just such a sweet person and waited for the lab test to come and all this. She just couldn't handle it. She developed a horrendous headache. I told all my villagers that, you know, this was a birthday celebration. We were going to bring her out and have a real nurse take care of her. And she couldn't take it. It was a mob scene. So anyway, my brief career was... I would sometimes have nightmares later on about being required to perform surgery or something. But I was, the Ford Foundation heard about it, and I was told to stop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they said, if anything happens, we're really in trouble. And I said, I'm fully sympathetic with your position, and I can't stop. I'm now in a position where it would be so profoundly resented that they would just create enmity. So I'm sorry I got us bogged into this, but I'm just going to have to be a doctor all the way through to the end. And they said, well, we can understand each other. And they delivered the message. They sent some guy to tell me that I should cease and desist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they were quite concerned.
They were aware that it would happen, and you know, something, and they could have. They were right. It was just that I couldn't get out of it.
Joe, one of your background sources, Dean Joan Reduca, said to me that a hallmark of your career was truth to power.
Okay.
Would this be one of the very early instances of that, when you chose to acknowledge the Ford Foundation's concern,
right,
but nevertheless refused to follow their dictates?
I wish it was as noble as that, but I literally had no choice. You know, they had made me a doctor, and if I'd gone out and said, sorry folks, no medicine from now on, there would have been so much bitterness, because there they were with their coughs and their runny eyes and their burns and so on, and why had my heart turned this way? It would have made any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
It could be made to sound noble, but I was trapped.
I understand that. But
I guess the truth was, I just told the Ford Foundation, it won't work. I can't not keep doing this.
Uh-huh.
And looking back, maybe if I hadn't taken care of that kid, it would never have happened. But we're stuck with this, and we just make the best of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the research, it probably was a useful research strategy, because I met all levels.
Uh-huh.
I was able to interview 40 village women, and there are very few American men who've interviewed 40 village women. And most of them, I had at some point, you know, put Vicks up their babies' noses, or you know, put a Band-Aid on the cut or something like that. So I think to that extent, I was seen as kind of a friendly person that they were at least they were willing to sit down and talk with. So that may have been kind of a cynical payoff, but, but in the best of all possible worlds, I would not have done it.
So during your 2 years there, though, you're gathering data.
That's right. You're
doing questionnaires, basically.
Yeah. I kept field notes every night, and then near the end, I drew samples from five different populations. Men who worked in the village, worked in the mill, men who never worked in the mill, wives in the village, the mill elite, these are high caste, mostly educated men, engineers, chemists, bookkeepers, and that, and their wives. And then would compare how they answered on a series of questions having to do with Hinduism and the role of large factories in Indian society and kids' education and things like that. So it was both the anthropologist's description of what was happening in a narrative way and interview data with. And the computers are just coming in. I processed my data with the old punch cards.
Oh, you did?
They dropped into slots, and we were the cutting edge of technology at that point. These little sorter, counter sorters they had, where at that point you would copy down the numbers, it would, the little dial that was here. And then the next year we got things that they printed them out. I thought, we are in heaven now. Not realizing that by the time we're here,
Yes. Eons
past that particular stage.
But you were doing the data tabulation back when you were back at Harvard.
That's right.
You weren't doing any of that in India.
No. But I'd set it up so that I could put the punches in. I'd punch the cards myself based off the interview data.
I see.
So it was all set up to, you know.
Yes. So once you got back, all you had to do was turn the cards in.
Or punch the cards.
Oh, you punch the cards.
I had the questionnaires that would say yes or no, or answer 3 out of 1, 2, 3, or whatever.
I see.
And then I just would go back in and punch the cards so that when it got to this column, they'd answer 3, but three punch appeared.
I see.
It's very primitive.
Yeah. It worked, I'm sure.
And it was the cutting edges, and the machines were huge in that case. So anyway, we sort of back to Harvard, and by now, enough things had happened. I guess I missed a whole section there in terms of the Korean War. Okay. This came senior year. I was already sort of in the track to... No, it came the end of junior year. The war broke out in Korea. And all of a sudden, we all were eligible to register for the draft. And I talked with the veterans in Oberlin. We were the first class for a long time to have a minority of veterans. All the classes ahead of us were G.I. Bill, and these were guys in their 20s, 23, 24, 25. And the faculty kept sort of being sorry that we were there. They said it was so great when we had the veterans, and yeah, you 17-year-old come in and you don't know anything about anything. But listening to the veterans talk, and they were a lifetime ahead of us, was very interesting. And I guess hearing them talk more or less confirmed my profound skepticism about making a point that a war achieves something great and noble. I was struck by the fact that most of them were not happy with what they had been asked to do. Most of them were somewhat resentful about how they'd been treated, which any GI, I guess, does feel. And the number of them would talk about stuff that they did which they, on second thought, they just, their lives, they would never have the same respect for themselves because of what they've been asked to do. And the story that was most poignant for me was from a guy, a class ahead of me called Van Henderson. And Van was a great joker. He, his job had been to take care of mules going up the Italian campaign. Mm. And he would load artillery pieces on the mules and take them to the top of the hills where the artillery was located. And then they'd fire the artillery on the Italians and the Germans as they pushed up toward Rome. And then he'd take bodies back, wounded people back, and then another trip. So he was relatively out of danger. He described this one event when it was raining, and he'd gotten his stuff up to the top of the hill, and a couple of young Italians had surrendered. And the officer in charge asked for volunteers to walk these two guys back down to where there was a prisoner of war camp to sign them in. And nobody wanted to, it was raining. And so he finally just picked two guys, you and you, take these guys back. So these two guys got up, and it was obviously weren't at all happy about doing this. And they said, okay, and they walked around the corner, and there were two shots, and they came back and said they tried to run away. And everyone knew they murdered these two guys in cold blood, just because it was too big of a bother to walk out. And Ben said, I could have done that. I was so tired about the whole thing that I could have murdered them, and it would, at that moment, it would not have struck me as murder. It just solves the problem. And everybody knew that these guys had been killed in cold blood, and nobody said anything. There was like no hearing. He said, at some point you stoop so low that you can't believe that you would be capable of that. But he said, I had become capable of that. And I'm not sure that's, I ever want to be in a position like that. So it was stuff like that that led me to weigh through, do I ever want to be in a position where it's me or him, you know, where I will have to kill somebody because otherwise they're going to kill me. And I decided at this point that I could take the responsibility of seeing that I would not be put in a position like that. Along with the fact that my feeling was that when the amount of devastation that war has generated was horrendous, and if you added all the pain of the civilians killed and damage and so on, it was at the price that was almost not worth paying. There are other ways of achieving whatever you were hoping to achieve through military means. So I applied to be a conscientious objector, knowing that I wasn't eligible. The requirements were that you had to be a member of a peace church, uh-huh. And I was a Presbyterian. Okay, uh-huh. And John Foster Dulles was a Presbyterian. And John
Foster was he?
Dulles thought the war was great.
Yeah,
right. Furthermore, the questionnaire you filled out began with the question: do you believe in a supreme being? Yes or no? Because to be a conscientious objector had to be based on a belief in a supreme being's instructions to you that you were forbidden to kill. That was the logic. It couldn't be based on philosophy or humanism. It had to be God-derived. And I didn't believe in a supreme being, unless it was a supreme being, something very vague and general. So I didn't check either box, and I wrote a long essay about what do you mean by supreme being? Is it something with an interact, or is it some cosmic process that works with chemistry and stuff? Anyway, I think I wrote an essay that was so confusing, the draft board. Well, we don't want this sort of person in the military. I also said, it was a long questionnaire and you had to fill out, and I described having watched World War II from backstage. This is enormous, you know, unnecessary suffering that people went through. And the fact that you ended up pitting young men against each other who had no grudge with each other and with the task of killing each other struck me as absurd. I also said, I talked with people who'd been in the medical corps, and they often felt that they were part of an instrument that was killing people, and so they couldn't say, well, I was a medic, therefore I'm not responsible for the fact that my colleagues are blowing people up or injuring them and then I'm taking care of them. So I, in my application, I said, I will not serve in any capacity. And ended up by saying, I realize that probably I don't qualify to be a conscientious objector, but I do want it clear that under no circumstances will I serve in the Army. So if you choose to identify me as non-eligible, then I will be in prison, but I won't be in the Army. I just want that to be clear. I'm not sure what combination of factors went into the fact that this draft board did give me the conscientious objector status.
Oh, it did.
It did. I was just as surprised as you were, right?
I was sitting here waiting to hear about your going to jail.
That's right, there I was. Well,
where was your draft board?
It was Elyria, Ohio, which is a conservative town that doesn't like Oberlin, because Oberlin is smart aleck rich kids,
uh-huh.
And Elyria is sort of rural Ohio, basically Republican, American flags in the front porch, all that kind of stuff. And I knew that they had hassled other people. In fact, I knew they'd hassled some genuine Quakers with bring them in and say, imagine your mother is being raped by a Japanese soldier. Would you stand by and, you know, if you're going to use force, then why don't you? And, the whole sort of logic off like that. And giving people just a hard time, you're cowards, you don't feel any sense of obligation, and, all stuff that goes with drafting. But I was never called in. And they just, and then 9 months later, I got this status, and it was just fine as far as I was concerned. Later on, when I was in India, I got a message from my draft board saying that they now had alternative assignments for conscientious objectors. We could be required to do non-military service, which had happened, I think, in World War II. So, first of all, I was to report to the nearest military installation for a physical exam, because I might be 4F, in which case I wouldn't be eligible, but if I passed the physical exam, then I was eligible for 1O or something like that. And they could tell me to work in a mental hospital or a forest preserve or firefighting or something. So I wrote back saying, well, the nearest military place is in Trieste, and I'm in South India, and there's no way I can get there within the 30 days I'm supposed to report. And besides, I feel pretty good, so I'm sure I'm okay physically. I'm not for it. So now we get to, what would you like to have me do? I'm here in South India teaching English. And incidentally, I'm now the father of a daughter. Would you put that in my file? Well, back came a letter from them, the usual, you know, 3 weeks or kind of thing, saying, well, if you have a daughter, then you are 3A. You're a married man with a dependent, therefore you're not eligible to serve. So I ended up sort of bypassing that by being classified in such a way that I never actually had either to serve as a CO or to go to prison, which was just fine as far as I was concerned.
Absolutely.
But two other things happened to make my wife and I decide we really probably were drifting into Quakerness if we weren't careful. One was that after Shanti, our daughter, was born, everybody wanted us to baptize her. And neither, because it was a very strong conservative Christian community around the schools we were teaching. And we both felt kind of funny about this. Neither of us was particularly deity-oriented.
Was your wife Presbyterian,
she,
too?
She was Evangelical and United Brethren.
Which
have since, I guess, merged with the Methodists.
Oh.
And there's and the Brethren part of it were a Peace Church. But she wasn't in any of the standard ones. But our senior year, we started going to Quaker meeting because we were in this whole draft thing and what should you do and the war on and so on. So we felt we didn't want to have our little daughter baptized because then there was a commitment to church and the Christian theology and so on. But we thought she'd do something because people felt she wasn't real until we had a naming ceremony. So we sort of anticipated. We said, well, we're sort of Quakers, and Quakers don't have these particular ceremonies. But we do have a naming ceremony, so we'll have a naming ceremony for her. And we'll sit in silence in the Quaker tradition, and anybody who wants to share any feeling about parenthood and children and so on, we'll share. We don't have a clergyman who will be in charge of this whole thing. There won't be any water on her head. In fact, she won't even be present. If she's nice, she'll keep sleeping through this whole thing. And so we had a Quaker naming ceremony for our daughter, which was totally made up. And there were at least six or eight clergy there, and of course they all rose and said things that they would say at baptism, so our little daughter was surely ushered into the life of religious responsibility. But it was not theistic, it wasn't, you know, specifically Christian in any way. Well, we were beginning to feel a little bit hypocritical about this whole thing by now. So when we did get back to Oberlin, and we were both working on a master's thesis, we were reconnected with the Oberlin Quaker meeting.
Uh-huh.
Which there were a few, maybe five or six Quaker couples, absolutely wonderful people. The track coach was one of them, and there was a builder there was one of them, and somebody else was working on medical instruments, and one was a school teacher. Anyway, very small set, plus whatever student Quakers there were. So we decided that, okay, we really are in the company of people that are friends, so let's go through the apply and become members of the Quaker meeting. So we formally became Quakers in grad school when we were in Oberlin.
Uh-huh.
But it was, you know, by then we were like asking your brother and sister to let you be Quakers because you knew them so well.
Joe, was this an issue for your parents?
They were, it was interesting because I hadn't realized quite where my parents stood on all of this. I knew they were unhappy with my becoming skeptical about God's existence. And they both said, we both went through that and we got out the other side and we believe in God. So there's a phase, so they're willing to see that. They were a little concerned with my willingness to think that maybe communism had a little bit to it in terms of equality and planning an economy for the general good, because communism was godless. So that concerned me a bit. Ironically, my father probably was the first intellectual to trip me out of Christianity, which is, I don't think he realized at the time. But in the little mission school we went to, we had to study the Bible along with everything else.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't like today in the schools where you can't do it. This was a mission school, and so whether you were Jewish or Muslim or Christian, you studied the Bible. And when he got to, I guess it was the eighth grade, my father taught Bible. He's a guy who knows the seminary. And I was intrigued because it was hard-headed stuff. You know, what are the texts, and what were the early texts, and did Mark write before Luke, and how do you get the data, and all this kind of stuff. And I was laughing at it.
This is side two of tape two of the October 10th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder.
Well, I learned the New Testament hadn't been constructed for about 80 years after Jesus died. I thought, now, how can you take that seriously? To assume that somebody, even 30 years later, remember word for word what Jesus said in some kind of sequence is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested that to my father. I
said, oh, my!
Right. Yeah. And he said, well, it seems strange, but we believe that that's what happened. And I thought, oh, come on, Dad. You've got to be smarter than that. This is a reconstruction or a guess or who knows what. But the whole notion that Jesus said exactly this makes no sense. And I didn't come out quite directly. My dad and I always had very cordial relations. And it'd be sort of a question, and then mm-hmm. he would answer it. And his faith was so strong that, and he was sure he had been through all these questions himself, and he'd come out the other way. But from that time on, I thought, this isn't true. Well, this isn't exactly true. The point may be there, but the notion that this is literally God's word is one of the more absurd things I've been asked to believe. So after that, I did something which now sounds quite heretical. I was supposed to read the Bible, a chapter of the Bible every night. This was something that you did. I had a pencil. And I think I still have the Bible. And I'd come to a section that struck me as absurd, and I either would cross it out, right, absurd. Miracles, raising the dead, the blind seeing, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so big chunks of the New Testament in my Bible were being sort of crossed out as just not, it didn't make sense. There were people we would imagine that a great teacher would raise the dead and do all these things, but that's... That'll happen in anything. And don't take it seriously. So I guess the beginning to look at Christianity through the lens of a critical intellectual was the beginning of something which then Harvey Goldberg and all series of people that says, you gotta look at this stuff for what it is.
Uh-huh.
And whatever you may have been given has to be held up and looked at with a fair amount of critical scrutiny. So one of the things I liked about Quakerism was that there was no confession of faith. It was the fact that you met in silence meant that there was no prior commitment. The fact that anybody who felt that they had some thought they wanted to share, a prayer or a hymn or just an observation, they could do it. The sense of a continuity that somebody would say something and then you'd be on their wavelength, and then if something occurred to you, somebody else, you might share it or somebody else would. The fact that all the decisions were made in unanimity, so that you never had a minority, and never the problem of, well, let's just vote, it's 9-1, sorry, one, you lost on this one.
Uh-huh.
You had to struggle through until everybody agreed. It's what's called the sense of the meeting. These were all things that I sort of liked positively, in addition to the fact that I didn't have to believe in the Trinity or the resurrection of the body or any of the other things.
I did not realize the Quakers did not have...
There's no creed at all.
That creed and dogma and so forth. I did not know that.
And there's a notion, it's called sometimes the continuing revelation, which is a fancy word for saying you are not obliged to hold to anything that's happened in the past if it strikes you as not being worthy of continuing. Now, in the Catholic Church, the person who has a continuing revelation is the Pope, and he can make new pronouncements. But in most traditions, there's the scripture and there's the sacred text, and then you can try to interpret it. But the notion that one could actually have a fresh insight to say, I think this is more relevant than what's written there, is not built into most religious traditions. Whereas the notion that a group of people focusing on something committed to truth may come up something which is different from what's been in the past, and therefore you don't have to say, well, we have never done it in the past, or we've always done it in the past, therefore we have to do it, but you can get a break from that. So anyway, these were things, along with the fact that the Quakers I met were a combination of saints and really strange people. Some very difficult people. But the thrust was sort of nonviolent action. The thrust was a commitment to the value of people, the notion that there is something sacred in each person. It's kind of a basic philosophy. And that I felt very comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
So we're now in Oberlin. I love teaching. I worked terribly hard on the courses I had. I hadn't been a TA. Well, I'd been a teaching assistant, but that was just grading papers. I never had a course to set up. And I went to Oberlin having had a job in the summer to earn money in India. And our third child was born while I was in India. Came back, we moved to Oberlin from Dayton, where I'd been living with my wife's family.
Did you have your PhD at this point?
I got my PhD, in 1959. I guess what it says here.
Okay. So you got your PhD, and then you went back to Oberlin to teach.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
I missed that. The first, I got my, in the spring of 59, when the PhD was in hand, the dissertation was done, I contacted the faculty members back in Oberlin and said, I'm going to be in the job market. Do you know any place I might apply? And they got back and said, well, we have a vacancy in Oberlin itself. Would you be interested in applying to Oberlin? And I thought, well, that was extraordinarily
fortuitous,
right? So I went to Oberlin on a job hearing, the trial, made one of my worst mistakes in terms of ever being interviewed, which was we had dinner in the Oberlin Inn, and they had something called guinea fowl or something like that, which I never had. So I ordered it. You ever eaten a guinea fowl?
I never had.
It comes complete with ribs and wings. It's about that big. And I was trying to answer questions and pick away this miserable little carcass, And if I had, I sort of put a little money in my mouth. Next time, get meatloaf.
Or maybe don't eat at all, I think.
So here was this big mess I was working on trying to go on. Anyway, these were old friends of mine. I'd been in classes with each of them. And I admired each one in their own way. So it was great fun to be hired back in Oberlin. I would have liked to have found a place where there was a place I could teach India, because by now I had this South Indian experience and I spoke Hindi. I had was really sort of interested in the idea of using the knowledge of another part of the world to teach. And Oberlin was very generous. They said, well, we can certainly give you a course on India, maybe once in a while a seminar in India, but we do have to do the meat and potatoes, the theory and the introductory sociology, because it's a four-person department or something like that. So I did teach a course called Civilization of India, which I drew from the Dan Ingalls course that I had. And then social theory, which I was in the middle of with Talcott Parsons, was the great theoretician, but it meant I had to do a lot of theory that I hadn't done, because everything in Oberlin, in Harvard was Talcott Parsons. So I just worked like a dog that first year. I remember sitting down the week before classes started and listing, three lectures a week, 15, so 45 lectures, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 45. You're going to give an exam every 6 weeks. And what will you talk about every single lecture? And I did that for all the courses I was going to teach. I had nothing to start with. And it was just, after supper, put the kids to bed, and then go to the office and try to figure out what on earth you're going to say it was intelligent next morning at 9 or next morning at 11.
Huh.
It was a pace that you could keep up, but not for very long. Fortunately, I had two sections of introductory, so I could take the same lecture for those two, but there was always another class. So every night I had either a whole new lecture, and once a week, two new lectures, starting with a blank piece of paper.
Wow.
That was hard.
Yes. You were working quite hard that year.
I was harder than I'd ever worked as a grad student or anything. Plus the feedback, plus the exams and all the rest. And I liked it. I mean, I really liked. A moment would come when you're working on a lecture and you'd suddenly say, that's how to do it. Here's the main point. here's what leads up to it. But often it was later at night than you, you wanted it to happen.
And Joe, were you writing out your lectures or were you doing an outline?
Outline, yeah. At that point it was just an outline.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always terrified that I wouldn't have enough for the 50 minutes. And so my usual thing would be to keep one eye on the clock and one eye on my outline. And then often I'd end up with a little bit left over because I was just being too cautious. But it paced myself. If I hadn't listed the lectures, I had all their titles there. I'm not sure how I would ever have gotten through the whole year.
Did you like teaching right off the bat, or did you have to grow into it?
It's very ego-satisfying. It's dangerous. It really is.
Huh.
Because, you know, they sit there taking notes like what you're saying is important. It takes you a while to get used to that. They'll ask you questions that will hit you right between the eyes. I will never forget, we had classes Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Oberlin went till noon on Saturday. And I think it was almost either my first or second Saturday morning, and most of us in the world think you shouldn't be working on Saturday morning. And I was making some statement about correlation and causation are two different things. And a student named Debbie Belcher said, "What's the difference?" Encouraged me. I had no clue. I don't know what the answer is. And I said something. I couldn't say nothing. I thought, what is the difference? Being, if it always correlates, mustn't there be some sort of... Anyway, these were the kinds of questions which you would think at some point in grad school you'd have to start their philosophy of science and all this kind of stuff. So I found myself being sort of my best teacher because there'd be these things that would hit me. And then I'd say, I read an enormous amount of philosophy and philosophy of science, which I had never touched anywhere along the line. You know, what does establish causation? What are the logical links and so on? And I thrived to the fact that people would give me these theory courses because there you are dealing essentially with ideas and conceptual relations and so on. And the fact that I had studied with Talcott Parsons meant that people assumed I was a theorist without realizing that after I put that box up there, I couldn't be very much with it. But all this other stuff was great fun. So, I was still in the first semester in Oberlin when Henry Hart got in touch with me, whom I had never heard of.
Oh.
And Henry called up one night and said, Wisconsin is starting a program in South Asian Studies. And he described a little bit the area center idea. Sputnik had been up there, and now federal money was going to be available for language centers and stuff. And Wisconsin was trying to bring together historians and political scientists and anthropologists, so it'd be a nexus and then do some language stuff. Well, there's like somebody saying, Joe, heaven has just knocked. This was exactly what I'd been looking for.
Why did Henry contact you?
I have no idea, except Henry was looking for a sociologist. And they were
had he read your dissertation?
I think probably he may have heard of it. You'll have to ask Henry that. I don't know. It's a good question.
It's very interesting.
Because there were almost none of us doing India at that time. They were just the first crop coming through. Everybody else was going to London, the School of Oriental and African Studies, or London University. Berkeley was beginning, this was 1960, I began teaching in 59, so this would have been the fall of 59, and the money had just become available because of Sputnik for universities to set up what we call a national cultural and language resource centers or something like that. And not just India, it was to be China, it was to be Southeast Asia, it was to be Africa, and so on. And this NDEA, National Defense Education Act, Title VI money. The sort of thing the Ford Foundation had been doing in a pioneering way now is being picked up by the federal government with the notion this is serious. So once again, it was sort of sheer good luck that money was going to come, and part of the, if the money was to be used to hire faculty who were interested in keeping the area component. So I came here in the winter. By now it's 60. Coldest day I'd ever lived in. It was probably only about 10 below, but it was unlivable.
Wisconsin was still cold then.
That's right, yeah, right. And I met with faculty who were wearing, you know, parachute boots and stuff like that, and parkas. And I thought, this isn't civilized. Bunch of Eskimos. And I remember I was staying in the old Memorial Union where there was some guest rooms. I remember coming out and just hitting the cold air hitting me. People can't live in this climate. But there wasn't so much here as a potential. There were a few sort of visiting Indians. Somebody was teaching a course on Gandhi, and Henry's doing something on the civilization of India, but it was the potential of bringing in the historians and the political scientists and getting something going that was just truly exciting, and the language training. So when the offer, and the Social Department was very good. I guess the real attraction was the fact that I could teach India stuff. I wasn't aware at that time, and the department wasn't that good at that time. It was probably 8th or 9th in the country at that time. Now it's been number one.
Which department?
The sociology department.
Sociology, okay.
Yeah, there was a chairman named Howard Becker who was a pretty painful person to work with. The morale was bad and so on. And he died before I met him. And almost everybody in the social department that I met said, you have no idea what much nicer place it is without Howard Becker here. I remember talking with at least one grad student said that he'd been traumatized by Howard Becker. Howard Becker was a dictator, and you read his book, and you talked from his book, and so on. And this grad student, I felt like I was talking with a person who'd been released from concentration camp.
Oh, really?
But anyway, the Social Department was good, obviously, but it was the India thing that I found really attractive, because there was almost no place that I could follow up my India interests. The only two centers that existed at that time were Cornell and Penn, and they each had a sociologist. And so that guy wasn't going to retire for probably 25 years. And otherwise, I'd be doing what I did in Oberlin, you know, once every second semester I'd teach something on India, but otherwise it would be the standard meat and potato that sociologists make their living at.
Joe, can I interrupt and ask you to speculate on what it was about Wisconsin? You know, I had an interview with Harold Choi, and I'm doing Daniel Kanane now.
All right.
And they're both talking about how early Wisconsin was to develop a program in African languages.
Right.
Wisconsin, out of the entire United States.
Right.
Wisconsin. Now, you're saying the same thing about Indian
right.
studies.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? What was it? What is it about the University of Wisconsin that allows for that?
It's probably a couple of key people, because the resources were out there. Suddenly the announcement was made by the federal government. But also, I think, administrators. I think my sense is that it was the Henry Hart Harrington combination.
President Harrington?
President Harrington, yeah. I'm trying to think of who was president before him. But the feeling Henry gave me was that the administration was looking around for money to do creative things. And here comes the word. Sputnik has shown the U.S. is in bad shape in terms of high tech and in terms of knowledge of the rest of the world. Money is going to be out there for those universities that move in and organize themselves so they can hire faculty and become resource centers. And Henry was, I think, a friend of Harrington. I'm sure there was somebody in the African Studies program who also was aware of this, because these were big bucks. You know, hire faculty to supplement whatever you had in your regular department. So it's like saying, here's free money, and the trick is they're going to come in as anthropologists, but they'll know India, or they'll come in as historians, they'll know Africa, or they'll come in as sociologists, and they'll know India. And so it was just a real, you know, a lot of sweetness coming in. But somebody had to be there with a receptor as an administrator, and then somebody with the ability to say, well, here are three of us who do Africa, let's come up with a proposal to have an African Studies Center. So Henry played a key part with whoever the Sanskritist was here at that time. And the two of them, with I think administration, helped put together the proposal that Wisconsin had Sanskrit and had political science. And if you could bring in the historians and others, Wisconsin would be a good place to have a center.
It just continues to fascinate me how this really mid-range state
right.
of Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
has this university that leads the vast majority of other universities in groundbreaking work.
Right.
And has for decades.
Yeah.
I was just interested in
right.
your observations.
Well, I think you spot the people who did it, but it's and the climate is very good for that, the notion. I know in the sociology department I picked up the theme very quickly that one reason that they built themselves to be number one or whatever one was, they were either at the very top or near the top, was that they would go for the best young person they could find at any point. rather than picking a star someplace and trying to bring them here so big name comes and comes with a couple of grad students, that often backfires because the big name made their glory someplace else and now they're going to come and sit on their laurels and want funds. Whereas you get a bright young person and give them space to run, give them time off so they get their publications, and you've got all this energy down there, which is relatively low cost. And if they make it through, they may be loyal and choose to stick around here.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's really very interesting to me. So you, Henry offered you a position in the winter of 1960.
Yeah, probably the phone call came in February or something like that. But I'd been bitten by the bug when I came here. So I was just finishing my first semester in Oberlin. And I had a 2-year contract in Oberlin. So I said, look, I'll stay in Oberlin until I sort of round out my contract, which Henry had no objection for. And then the second year I was in Oberlin, everybody knew that I was only going to be there for that second year. And I was already sort of beginning to be attracted to things I was hearing about. Marshall Clenard was a criminologist here. And in time he did some work in India, and then Henry Hart was here. I met Gene Boardman, who was in East Asian studies, but he was a Quaker. So it was obvious, you know, a number of things going here. So we moved here in the summer of 61, and Henry had set up two things that made it instantly attractive. One was that I had paid for the summer.
Oh.
And he had set up a program where there were, I think, 4 or 5 of us with area specialties who met once a week in a faculty seminar to talk about nationalism and identity. Jan van Sina from Africa.
Oh.
I was from India. Had some guy from Berkeley who was doing China, and then he was there. And the whole issue of how do you build nationalism, how do you prevent nationalism from becoming super nationalism so that it absorbs the stuff. And it was just, you know, we would have each other read things and then meet and talk about it. Well, that could never happen in a place like Oberlin. Then I had to sell the library, got my first article put together so I could start publishing, because I had not been set up to do very much publishing when I was in Oberlin, and that had to be a shift of gears coming here. And then the teaching, I had a couple of courses I could fall back on, so that was easier, and then new courses that I could teach. So it was just great to be here.
When you first came, though, you were just in sociology.
No, I was 2/3 sociology, 1/3 what was called Department of Indian Studies.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, right off the bat.
Right off the bat, yeah. So there were various things. There was a Center for South Asia, which has a federal funding, and its job is to make sure that things happen, courses are taught, visitors come, seminars are held, and it can take some of its money to pay for faculty. And then there was a Department of Indian Studies, which had to have enough integrity for deans to say, yes, you can give a BA in this and an MA and a PhD. And so that requires faculty input and courses and all the rest. And Henry had done the bulk of the work on that as well. So there was a Department of Indian Studies, and there was the Center for South Asia. And the center could take the federal money and pay bits and pieces of salaries, especially sweeteners, to get somebody here for a couple of years.
I see.
And then have the history department pick them up after that or whatever. So Henry was just a very good organizer of getting this stuff together. So while I was here, all kinds of exciting people were coming in. The first team sort of here. Richard Robinson came in, who was a Canadian, who was a Buddhologist. I never met a Buddhologist.
Huh.
And he knew Tibetan and Chinese and Japanese and a bunch of things. Bob Frickenberg came here in the history department. Bob had been a missionary kid.
Oh, had he?
In Andhra Pradesh, so he spoke Telugu from there. Then I enjoyed having people teaching Hindi classes. I mean, here were linguists. Bill McCormick was here, a Canadian linguist, and he was doing stuff with Indian languages. So just, you know, here was a feast. Just have fun with it. The very first year I was teaching, which is 61-62, another feature that I found attractive was the study abroad program. I'd heard that there was a study abroad program that Wisconsin had. And Henry implied that there was something in place, they were working on it. I arrived here, I got very busy with my classes, and then second semester I was teaching the course on Civilization of India, Modern Period. And I told the class, I think there may be a study abroad program that Wisconsin is running. Would anybody be interested in finding out? And there are four or five. Oh, sure, we can study in India. So I went to Henry and said, do we actually have a program? And he got this kind of funny look in his eye and said, well, we do have five students in India right now. And he said, well, how's it going? He said, we probably should find out. It turned out that Henry, in all the stuff that he was doing, had decided there was a little bit of money. He knew people in the Carnegie Foundation, and it was fairly easy to get money for things in India, the Ford Foundation and so on. So he'd gotten some money, and the idea that why don't we pick five BAs from different places in Wisconsin and give them a free year in India? And they put this together, and they'd gotten a couple from Beloit and somebody from Lawrence and somebody from UW. And had given them essentially a year fellowship to travel to India and do some language training and sort of whatever else they could do. It was incredibly unorganized. Well, there were these five people in India, five students. And when I asked, is there going to be a program for next year, Henry said, well, we probably should find out how this year went. And so again, looking back, he and Jerry Kelly, who was a linguist, in the linguistics department, and was chair of the department, and he was the director of the center, had lunch with me in the faculty club. And as I look back on it, it was the old pincer movement. One side, and here's assistant professor in the middle. And they were going to talk about the programs. I said, well, does it exist? And will there be a program next year? And they said, well, we probably could get the money, but we should also find out how this last year went. And Henry says, well, I can't go. And Jerry says, I can't go. And this is about 3 weeks before spring break, to get how late in the year it was.
Oh, my.
So I said, well, I probably could go. Said, well, okay, why don't you go over and find out what happened to these five students? So I left as early as I could and spent my week in India, found these five. Each had had a horrible year in terms of illness, lack of direction, frustration, sense of being abandoned. It was terrible. Henry had set it up in conjunction with the Yale School of Social Work because he knew the director of the school.
Oh.
And the school had internships where he'd work in orphanages, he'd work in women's homes or something like that. And the idea was that these students could do some sort of field work project with these things. But it was much too complicated. So for most of them, after they'd gotten there and they decided they didn't like their Hindi teacher and had dismissed her, they were very much on their own to do whatever they could. And when I was there in, by now, March, I suppose, they had mostly found something, but it was very, very improvised and not academically tight at all. So with each one, I would say at the end, well, it sounds to me as though we should just shut this down. This is, you know, you had a horrible year, and we should apologize for the fact that we sent you out the way we did with so little guidance. And everyone said, no, India's fantastic. If we can just work something out. But we just, you know, didn't have the right combination, we got sick and all the rest. So I came back with that report, and Henry was able to call somebody in the Carnegie Corporation and get money so that late in the semester we could announce that I think 15 people could go, more or less with most of their expenses paid, on a fairly serious year in India program. And it was going to involve language training in the summer. And then they go to three different institutions in India and enroll in classes in those institutions. And since I was going to be in India that year on a research grant, I could sort of monitor what was going on. So pieces seemed to fall together. We selected
the... And you were able to get three universities to cooperate in that short time period?
Between Delhi's... With Henry's knowing the Delhi School of Social Work, so we already had 1 year there, Dick Robinson was... in Benares Hindu University, he knew the staff there. And Delhi and Henry knew somebody in a Muslim institution that was near the Delhi School of Social Work. But this was, you know, when I think of the day of email and details, this was, would you be able to take some students? Sure, we'd take some students. Okay, we're going to send them. It was that level. Very, very from the hip. So we had the language training. I got to know the students. We all got out to India. Sort of the end of August, I guess it was. And I got them to their separate institutions, and now they're in place, they have their language teachers, they have the source to do. They're all supposed to do independent research projects. And now I'll get onto my research, which was to be in Lucknow, which is not where any of these were. Well, to make a long story short, I didn't get any research done from September until about March, because every possible thing went wrong, not once, but multiple times.
Was your family with you?
Yes, too? Not only my family, we now had three kids, and my mother-in-law was with me, so we had the whole sort of unit there. I had a research grant from the American Institute of Indian Studies, and this was almost the first year it was set up. Subsequently, I became president of the Institute. I was one of the first rookies to go out. And among other things, they were trying to figure out how to handle the taxes. And in January, I got a letter saying, I'm sorry, but we've discovered that the tax is so high on your fellowship that you aren't going to get any more money from now, because all of it has to be paid in taxes.
Really?
Wife, mother-in-law, three kids. How do I get back to the States? It was very much wilderness out there. Finally, they worked something out, because it was a joke. You know, we're not going to get any money anymore. But I learned a lot about trying to set up a study abroad program, and all the things that can go wrong and all the things that can go right. So it worked out. Most of the students had a year they could feel somewhat responsible for, that they learned something. They wrote fieldwork projects, most of them. Most of them got moderately good with language.
Uh-huh.
And in the meantime, since it was sort of working, Henry was able to get some more money here and get the next group going. So that there were I was with the class of 62, 63. The class of 63, 64, Henry kind of super.